This is a podcast from CSIS, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a private nonpartisan think tank located in Washington, D.C.
Good afternoon. I'm Johanna Nesseth-Tuttle. I head the CSIS Food Security Initiative. And today I'm speaking with Tim Mahoney, who's a former official with USAID, and Melinda Smale, who's a senior researcher at Oxfam. Tim and Melinda are the authors of our new report on approaches to increase agricultural productivity in the developing world. Tim and Melinda, thanks for joining us this afternoon. As we start out, we'd like to get an overview of your report and some of the key points. And I'd like to ask if you could, Tim, perhaps outline some of the main challenges to growing food and feeding increasing populations worldwide. Tell us a little bit about why crop yields are low and what some of the challenges are.
Okay, Johanna, thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here today to talk about the report. I think it's a very timely topic. I think this is a good place to start in terms of the challenges, because you do hear some estimates of the challenges facing food production in the future, 9 billion people by the year 2050. I think the World Bank estimates that by 2030 there could be as much as a 50% increase in demand for food. So clearly there are some major challenges out there. I do think that the question, though, is not just one of availability. It is also a question of access. I think in our paper we focus more on the availability issue, and that's what I'll start with. But I think later on in the conversation perhaps we can get to some of the access issues. When we talk about meeting those challenges, I mean, the bottom line is that there is going to be a need to increase food production in the coming years. And many people talk about the need for a 21st century green revolution, sort of replicating the successes of the first green revolution in the 1970s and 1980s. Melinda and I think, though, that when we talk about a 21st century green revolution, it's going to be quite a bit different than the successes of the earlier green revolution. And the distinction that we like to make is that the earlier revolution was really based on inputs. It was input intensive, and seeds, fertilizers, and irrigation systems were really the drivers behind that green revolution. The green revolution for the 21st century, though, we think is going to be quite a bit different. And we like to refer to it as a knowledge-intensive green revolution. And by that we mean it's really going to be built on better on-farm management practices. Examples of that include sustainable land use management, increased water efficiency, or more crop per drop, as some people like to refer to it as, and also improved seeds. I think, though, in trying to address this challenge, one of the things that is clear is that we are going to need more and better investments in agriculture, and that these investment strategies for the future really must recognize, I think, the important role that smallholders play in supporting food security in their own countries and globally.
I think most everyone is in agreement that increasing productivity is going to require sustained intensification of farming systems. But just how that intensification is achieved is what has been discussed and what is being debated. And as Tim mentioned, I think our focus is on knowledge and the attention to the soil and water resources that underpin any seed-based technical change.
Well, and on that note, Melinda and Tim as well, I'd like to ask if you could spend a little bit of time talking about some of the main problems that do inhibit ag productivity and some ways in which this knowledge-intensive green revolution is going to have to be approached in order to be effective.
I think it's sobering to think of the fact that, yes, so much was achieved in that first green revolution. There's no doubt about that. But we have estimated with maps based on detailed data that about one-third of the farmers in the developing world in low- and middle-income countries have neither access to good quality land nor good access to markets. And these are the most fundamental elements for productivity. Without land and without markets, how can farmers find a pathway out of poverty? So this means that the challenges of today are different from the challenges of yesterday. They're bigger.
You know, and to add to that, I think those challenges that Melinda's referring to are only going to be exacerbated by, in many places, hotter and drier growing conditions. I think they're going to be exacerbated by really increased competition for land and water resources. And, you know, I don't know if they'll be exacerbated by certainly the weak governance structures in many of these countries has made a response to the opportunities and problems now presented to smallholders that much more difficult.
Thank you very much. Turning now to another issue, I'd like to ask if you could highlight some effective approaches and successful ways to connect farmers with technologies and innovations and again, ways to bring about this knowledge-intensive green revolution.
I like to think of successful, sustained farmer adoption as being a question of farmers knowing about the technology they're using, having choices about the technology they're using, and being able to make effective decisions. And that means that they have good information. And most of the poor farmers in the world do not have good information, and they often don't have a range of choices in technologies. And so it's very important to develop configurations of actors and players that can help farmers achieve those sorts of conditions. And today, for farmers with limited access to markets who are farming in very difficult environments, you really need more than just sort of a formula that's delivered by a centralized agricultural research and extension system. You need to have public sector actors, private sector actors like agro dealers, small seed companies, traders, farmers associations, and local NGOs or community-based organizations, and sometimes international nonprofit organizations involved in helping to adapt technologies to farmers' conditions and working directly with farmers in their communities. And that means there's no formula, there's no universal model that can be promoted. There has to be a lot of innovation and a lot of creativity and a lot of work from the community up. So some of the examples of approaches that follow this sort of, some examples of approaches of this type include farmer field schools, which were very successful, particularly in Asia, in promoting integrated pest management practices, but have now been used for a broader range of farming practices, including improved soil and water management methods and techniques. A lot can be achieved, as Tim said, by changing farming practices. Another example is one that I know about that's being undertaken by the International Crops Research Institute for the Semi-Arid Tropics. That's ICRISAT. ICRISAT works a lot with non-hybrid crops in difficult environments, semi-arid environments. And ICRISAT scientists have been working with local organizations, agro dealers, the public sector, with what they call the foundation seed enterprise approach, and trying to develop, to foster smaller seed companies to multiply and diffuse seed into more difficult environments. Some of these companies are actually operated by agro-dealers. Other approaches of ICRISATS include working directly with farmers' associations, that's particularly in Sahelian West Africa, to multiply seed. And farmers' associations are particularly adept at diffusing seed into difficult environments where commercial seed systems, seed companies may not operate. I only want to make one point with respect to seed because it came up during the last food crisis, and that is there's often sort of a simplistic connection that's made between food insecurity and seed insecurity. And in fact, food insecurity does not necessarily imply seed insecurity or vice versa. And the experience with emergency seed distribution on the part of actors such as Catholic Relief Services and other organizations who work on the ground is that emergency seed relief can undermine local seed systems and in particular be quite disruptive for these fledgling seed enterprises that we've just been talking about.
Thank you for that. Go ahead, Tim.
No, please, Joanna, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to move to the next question, so if you have anything to add, please.
But could I just add quickly? I think the term that I like best is demand-led innovation systems.
Mm-hmm.
And when we talk about demand-led systems, I think we have to recognize who these farmers are. We keep using the term farmers. Most of them are women. And as we know, women haven't had the greatest opportunity to participate in national extension systems in the past. They were basically male-dominated. So I do think as we talk about demand-led systems in the future, we have to find innovative ways to make sure that all members of the community, the women and other groups that might be excluded from existing systems, have an opportunity to participate. I think one of the ways to encourage that is through the kinds of innovations that we like to refer to as viral spreads. And these are innovations that oftentimes farmers themselves teach each other, they recognize the value of, and then borrow from one another. I think there's some important characteristics of those kinds of innovations. And the fact that the benefits are quite visible is one of them. And usually you see those benefits very early on in taking part in the innovation. I think also low startup cost is really important. And even a stepwise sort of adoption of the innovation. It's not an all-or-nothing kind of innovation that farmers are presented. And I think lastly, and this goes back to a point that Melinda was making, that it does build on local knowledge. It acknowledges the fount of information these farmers have and builds on that for increases in productivity and improved resiliency of their systems.
Thank you. I wanted to move to the next question and ask you to talk a little bit about ways that countries can improve their management of natural resources and ways to combat drought and deal with an increasing lack of rainfall.
I think that it's an interesting way of phrasing it, because when we think about countries, I think we recognize the crucial role of national governments and local governments in establishing rights to land, water, and trees. And these rights are fundamental for providing farmers with the incentive to be good custodians of natural resources. And when we move to the local level soon, quickly, because if change is to occur on the ground and not in meeting rooms, there's a lot of change that's discussed in meeting rooms in capital cities that doesn't really occur in farmers' fields. So experience has shown that large-scale, government-led reforestation and soil improvement programs often fail because local people, local communities just don't buy into them. And I believe that we even have this same experience in the United States. And there's nothing particularly startling in this concept. But story that I have been following very carefully over the past 9 months or so is the story of farmer-managed agro-environmental transformation in parts of the West African Sahel. And this is a case that has been fully documented in a book and a set of background papers that were recently published by the International Food Policy Research Institute. And this book is called Millions Fed, Proven Successes in Agricultural Development. This was also documented in earlier extensive work by scientists at USAID, working with partners on the ground in the region. And it's basically that after the tremendous human and environmental catastrophe of the Sahelian droughts, which occurred during the 1970s and early 1980s, there is visible evidence over vast expanses of land that farmers themselves have rehabilitated about 250,000 hectares of degraded land in the central plateau of Burkina Faso, using techniques for constructing contour bunds to harvest water and digging planting pits that basically create a microenvironment so that yields can increase. You have a concentration of water and organic matter in the planting pits, and you also have the collection in the manure, in the animal manure, of seeds. So it's possible to regenerate forests, trees on farms. And these have been called agricultural parklands. And recent evidence in South Central Niger is that this sort of process has happened with a technique for natural regeneration of trees. This was a traditional technique which was discontinued during the colonial period because it was thought to be ineffective. And in fact, it's proven to be very effective. While the colonial efforts to reforest failed, for the reasons that I mentioned earlier, they were perceived as forest and top-down. This effort is now estimated to cover 5 million hectares. So 5 million hectares of regenerated parklands, that is, farmland with complex mosaics of trees, buns, across a large, wide landscape.
That's just such a fascinating example, and I want to add just a little bit to it, because in addition to the kinds of practices that Melinda is describing, the benefits they have for farmers there, they also have benefits for the local environment. And I think not just in this instance, but in many instances, we have to become better aware of the public goods that farmers are contributing to, and find ways to incentivize that behavior. I mean, payment for environmental services is becoming much more common, and I think we have to build that into our efforts to support smallholder agriculture in the future. I think the best example of this is related to climate change. I mean, many of the practices that Melinda just described regarding the Sahel really sequester carbon from the atmosphere. And, so it's not just benefiting the farmers and what they do, but it's having a global benefit. And there are other practices that smallholders are adopting, alternate wetting and drying of their wet rice fields, for instance, that are having similar benefits. And I think we have to be courageous and innovative in our efforts to support and incentivize these kinds of improved practices.
Thank you very much. Those are very interesting comments. And I want to move to one last question. I'd like to ask you to talk about some examples of soft infrastructure improvements that can increase and improve ag productivity and market access.
Well, we just mentioned the softest, but perhaps the most important of all, which is governance. and that is that farmers need rights, and they need to know their rights to land, water, and trees. When we talk about markets, we can make similar points. Farmers need to know when they go into their own village market, their small village local market, that they'll receive a fair price for their product. Agro-dealers and traders are also often very small-scale operators in these environments, and they need to be able to develop good business relationships that are based on trust. We know that governments can protect farmers and small-scale traders in village markets through various rules, simple rules of operation, in addition to providing the basic physical infrastructure of water points and shelter from the sun and the rain, sanitation. They can provide grades and standards that will improve the development of markets. So there's a lot that governments can do, and we've actually referred to that as soft infrastructure in the report. USAID has produced a great set of briefs, reports, and guidelines on this topic under the Business Climate Legal and Institutional Reform Initiative. I think it's called BizClear.
Yeah, that's a great program. And I think one of the things that comes through in this program, but many other efforts related to institutional reform, is the importance of property rights. The kinds of behaviors that Melinda's been talking about, that I have been talking about, are clearly that much more valuable when there is clear title to that land. When the kinds of longer-term benefits that you see from changing your behavior, you accrue those benefits. They don't belong to someone else. So property rights is certainly a highlight of the work being done under BizClear. But I also think agricultural finance is something that needs to be talked about in this context as well. I mean, it has such a horrible reputation. What happened back in the first Green Revolution was that governments recognized that the new more input-intensive systems of agriculture that they were encouraging adoption of needed credit. And they often set up their own credit programs to enable farmers to purchase these inputs. Well, they were poorly run programs, and just the worst habits you can imagine developed. Farmers rarely, in some instances at least, repaid that credit, and it never really became a sustainable finance system. I think what happened as a consequence is that people just backed out of the area of agricultural finance altogether. And so in most countries, there's this huge gap in agriculture markets, and that's related to agriculture finance. I do think some very interesting innovations are beginning that have the potential of closing that gap. I want to go back to property to begin with, and it's not so much land property, but it's movable property. And the cost of setting up a movable property registry, I think, is in the neighborhood of $500,000. I mean, land titles can take you years and millions of dollars. But with these registries, you have a basis for developing collateralized loans. And so many countries are moving quickly in that direction so that farmers do have easier access to loans. Other innovations, warehouse receipts. You know, I mean, the agricultural system here in the United States depends upon warehouse receipts. But in other countries, these systems have yet to really take hold. And they're being introduced. The idea is that a farmer, when he harvests his crop, brings it into a warehouse, receives a receipt for the goods that he stores there, and doesn't sell them right then, sell them at a time in which prices are just rock bottom, but holds them there until prices increase. With that receipt, though, he can get a loan and survive that period in which he's waiting to sell those goods. I think the last example that I wanted to mention was insurance. And again, experience with this in these kinds of instruments has been very, very dismal in the past. But new sorts of insurance instruments, one that are index-based, oftentimes based on weather conditions, the amount of rainfall. And this is giving farmers a way to manage risk that they didn't have before. I think for farmers being asked to adopt new practices. I mean, the first calculation they make is, you know, what's going to happen, you know? They can't afford losing their entire crop. The consequences are just too great. So these kinds of risk transfer mechanisms that are a part of that are a part of these insurance products, I think, are really, really important for, again, giving farmers the opportunity to make better choices, to take advantage of new opportunities related to their own production.
Well, thanks to both of you for taking the time to talk with us and explaining in a little bit more detail some of the things that are in your paper. The paper that Tim and Melinda has put out, we would encourage all listeners to read. It can be found on our website, csis.org. And before we close, I'd like to ask Tim and Melinda, are there any final words that you'd like to mention or things that we haven't hit on that you think are important?
No, thank you. I very much appreciate the opportunity to talk about the paper a bit, and I continue to be very enthusiastic about some of these possibilities that Tim has described. I still believe that there's a lot that we will be able to accomplish, but we're just going to have to be very innovative.
Yes, Joanna, thank you for giving us this opportunity. It's a topic that Melinda and I care deeply about. I think there's little question that the world has awakened to the reality that food price crises, food security, is an issue that we can no longer be complacent about. I think the challenge is going to be moving away from sort of the conventional approaches of the past that indeed produced results. Sometimes results that we're now seeing had more negative consequences than we initially realized, but certainly important results. But those aren't the solutions for the future. We have to probe new paths to find those solutions. And so I think the most important message coming out of the paper is that smallholders have a vital role to play in the future of food production, and it's up to us to let them play that role.
Well, thanks again to both of you, and we're looking forward to hearing reactions to the paper.
For more, please visit us online at www.csis.org.